Immerse yourself in the lives of the BYU Cougars. This is Deep Blue.
This is Deep Blue with Jason Shepherd.
Hey Cougar fans, with the BYU basketball season right around the corner, we're excited to announce that next week we'll be releasing our interview with Mihailo Boskovic. But this week we're highlighting another one of BYU Radio's amazing podcasts, Legends of 84, which tells the stories and perspectives of the players who led the Cougars on their legendary national championship run. This episode features Trevor Matich, ESPN analyst and frequent guest on BYU Sports Nation.
This is Legends of 84, the story of BYU's remarkable national championship football team, told by the men who changed the world of college football and were forever transformed by that unforgettable season.
We knew we were going to be good. How good? Nobody knows.
I just never thought we'd lose. And each game that we won, we got more and more confident.
But once we played next to each other, we protected one another.
You're not willing to prepare, then you're not going to be ready to win.
We are a peculiar people. We need to embrace that.
Brigham Young University has won the Holiday Bowl 24-17, and the Cougars are the only undefeated team in the nation. And I think they'll be number one.
You know, you got to give credit to Trevor Matich, the center, number 50. He not only has to snap the ball and read the defense, make the offensive line call, but he's got a pull. And he pulls on all the sweeps, and that's unusual for a center. They ask him to do a lot more than usual a center usually does. You see Lake and Craig Garrick out there, but Trevor's also out there leading the play. And that's a tough play for a center to snap the ball.
I grew up in Sacramento, California, raised by a divorced mother of four. She was a school teacher. I only played football because it was the only sport that let me be on a school team. This is Trevor Matich, center. I was one of the smaller, slower kids in my class. I was the last kid picked at recess for softball and football, and sometimes they wouldn't pick me at all. Sometimes they'd choose teams at recess and then go play and leave me there standing, and I wasn't selected, and I had a teacher would have to come over and make them let me be on the team because I just was horrible. I tried out for the sixth grade basketball team, and I made the team because they let every sixth grader be on the team because they figured the next year we would move on to junior high, there'd be more competition, and this might be the last chance that we would have to be on a school team. I never played. And so I got to seventh and eighth grade junior high, tried out for the baseball team and basketball teams, got cut from both of them, was kept on the flag football teams because they had no cuts, but I'd never played. My mom washed my jersey once in a while because she didn't want me to feel bad, but she didn't have to because it never got dirty. Sophomore year, I just moved up to the JV because it was an age thing and didn't play. Junior year, I got into one game early in the season in football, never played again, and tried out for the basketball team all three of those years, got cut all 3 years. So now senior year rolls around. And what should I have done? Probably should have realized that this whole sports thing wasn't working out for me and not tried out for the football team, but it never dawned on me that I should quit. So I went back out for the football team, and I had grown from a short, skinny kid to a tall, skinny kid, and I had developed really good footwork along the way. For the first time ever at a school sport, I earned a starting position. I was center. And that year, I was all-conference, all-Sacramento, all-Northern California. I was nominated for high school All-American, and I got scholarship interest from about 60 schools. It was a pretty good year. But see, all those other years when I wasn't any good, I wanted to be good. So I went before practice and worked on drills. After practice, stayed a little bit late, worked on drills. I wasn't good at them. People made fun of me because I just was very uncoordinated. But by the time I got to my senior year and my body grew into my desire, all of a sudden, I was ready for any doors that might be open, and then they opened. BYU offered me a scholarship. It was over four teams on the West Coast, Cal, UCLA, Arizona, Oregon. I chose BYU. I showed up as a 17-year-old freshman.
It's my fault. That's Matich. With a key block on somebody there in the red uniform. Did you see him as he went down on his back?
She wasn't a sports mom. She wasn't that kind of a mom. I don't think she knew much about football at all, although she tried to follow it. She was so cute. You know, when I got into the NFL, I'm out playing somewhere east of the Mississippi River for the Patriots, the Colts, Jets, and she'd be back in Sacramento clipping out actual news clippings with scissors out of the newspaper about what the 49ers were doing and what the Raiders were doing, you know. And you know, as I broadcast, she would take notes on what I said and what she liked and what I could do better and things like that. And I never stopped her because she just loved that so much. But she did it because she loved me. It wasn't a stage mom kind of a thing. It was just that she just loved me, and she didn't know how to help me with sports except just to watch and cheer me on, and that's what she did. And I'm just forever grateful for that. When people ask me about her, the thing that I tell them is that she was relentlessly cheerful and relentlessly loving. And everybody has problems in their life, and she had her share for sure. But you'd never know it because she never put it on us, the kid. She only showed us that face that she loved us. That was it. And then the struggles that she had to provide for the family, we never knew. We just knew that when you walked over to the light switch and you flipped it up, the light came on. We knew that when it was time to go play Little League, there was a baseball glove in the closet we could grab and go play. Now, a lot of times the shoes I had holes in the bottom, but I thought that was normal. She would eventually save up and buy me a new pair of shoes, and she would go 5 years wearing canvas boat shoes with holes getting bigger and bigger as a school teacher because she spent her money on us. And we never understood that until we were adults. And now we look back with not just gratitude, but such awe at how she sacrificed for us. And that's what great mothers do. Growing up within the church was a wonderful thing. My scoutmaster was a man named Kerry Meinzer, who was an old school mountain man. He looked like it, he acted like it. Every month we'd go out on a weekend camp out. 3-day weekends, it'd be a two-nighter. And then every summer, we'd go on a week-long 50-miler, whether it was a whitewater river trip or a hike. He knew what my situation was, where I needed that strong male role model. So when we were out on scouts, I remember things would happen, and he knew they weren't big things, but to me, they were big things, and he wouldn't fix them for me. He would say, you know what, your mother isn't here, figure it out. And then he'd take off. I was shocked, but I figured it out. And guess what? I learned how to be more self-sufficient that way. I learned how to figure things out and that everything was okay and that I did have power in my life. And it was because of Terry Meinzer. And then it continued with great coaches in high school and then especially at BYU, just immeasurably awesome builders of boys into young men and young men into grown men. When it comes to the influence that great football coaches have on their players, not just as players, but as men, it comes down to perspective and choices. What's important in life? How do your choices in the moment affect what's important in life? If you're able to pick that up as a young man, as a kid, then that just snowballs into positive things happening in your life. Football coaches can get everything out of players if the players know that the coaches legitimately love them. If it feels to the players like the coach is pushing them because the coach wants to use the players to get a bigger job, you're not going to have the kind of growth as individuals, and you're not going to have the kind of team success as you would have if the coach loves you. Now you'll do anything for them. And you mirror that then with your teammates. And that is one of the ironies of it all, that if he builds young men first, those young men will naturally become better football players. They'll be more coachable. They'll work harder. They'll avoid the pitfalls and distractions off the field and away from that. Build the young man first, and your team will be better, rather than the other way around, which some coaches do.
First and 10 on the BYU 36-yard line. Bosco at quarterback. Baxter split, drops back in the pocket, has great protection, throws over the middle. This one is caught by Bellini across the 45 to the 43-yard line.
I was sitting with Nick Saban in his office a number of years ago, and I asked him, what is it about this massive undertaking that is Alabama football that makes it successful that people outside the program don't understand? And I expected him to say that, you know, you bring in the right people, you get them focused in the right direction, and everybody, that's what I thought he was going to say. Instead, he didn't hesitate. He looked me in the eye and he said, Alabama football is successful because the primary goal of every person in this organization is to maximize the experience of the student athletes. Off the field, academically, in their personal lives, and in football. And by maximizing their experience, we're able to build a championship football program. That was the first time I had heard it put into words what Lavelle Edwards was doing with us the entire time. One of the things I remember about Lavelle is that he never had to raise his voice. Occasionally he did, but he did it for effect. But when he spoke quietly, it was like a thunderbolt hit because everybody respected him so much, didn't fear him, respected him. Assistant coaches in practice sometimes would yell and scream at us. It would go in one ear and out the other because for some reason we just weren't having a focused practice. That happens when you're a college student. And on that rare occasion when Lavelle decided to speak up, because he never said much on the practice field, he would just say, "Men, come on, let's go." Something like that, quietly. And the hammer of Thor came down and smashed all of us. And we were stunned into silence and then focused right back in. When Lavelle spoke, it was a different kind of experience. He always spoke with power, but it was always quiet. There were a couple of things that made the 1984 team so special. The first was that we were experienced. We had a lot of veteran players on that team. The offensive line was four seniors and a junior. And then it branched out from there. Another thing was that there were no stars on that team within the locker room. We had stars. We had big stars. Robbie Bosco was, I think, third in the Heisman voting. Glenn Kozlowski at receiver. Jim Herman at defensive line. Kyle Morrell. Leon White, for goodness sake. I mean, what an absolute amazing football player Leon White was. Kelly Smith might have been one of the fastest players in all of college football. We had stars on that team, but within the locker room, nobody treated themselves like they were a star. Nobody treated anybody else like they were a star. We were a family. We were a brotherhood. We were all together, and there was never any rift of any kind over who gets the credit, over who's getting the credit, over who does what and who doesn't do what. We all knew we were all giving the best we had towards a common goal. We were playing hurt towards a common goal. We loved each other as a brotherhood. And when you look at all the talent that we had, and we had talent, we had NFL guys on every level of the defense and the offense. Guys that got into the NFL, got paychecks from the NFL, lots of talent. But ultimately, what made that team great was that we were a brotherhood like I've never experienced before.
Trevor Maddich isn't too happy about it.
Encroachment, defense.
Maybe 5 yards for BYU, but Maddich, the center, had to take a good shot from Massetti coming across.
You can't have that kind of a brotherhood without everybody sharing in the sacrifice towards a common goal that means the world to you. And football isn't the world, but in the moment, in the sphere of football, it is the world. And it was such an enormous undertaking for us to go from where we started that season, the path towards the national championship, knowing what we were building towards, and everybody pulling together in the same direction. And there was a love for one another that was just, it was astonishing. And as the years go by, we lose touch with each other. But then we get together for an event or an anniversary, and maybe we haven't seen each other for 10 years, but it's like we've never been apart. And it's like we relish those moments we get to be together again. And we dread those moments when we have to then separate and go back to our lives in different states, looking forward to the next time that we can do it. And it's because of the brotherhood that was forged, because of the shared sacrifice, and because of the fact that we had nobody in that locker room that acted like the star that they really were in terms of their performance on the field. One of the things that made that 1984 team special was because we knew that we could have fun together. We found out that Louis Wong was afraid of snakes. He never should have told us that, never. And worms, by the way. We were working out in the weight room, and the weight room at the time was kind of long and narrow. I had gone to the department up on campus that had the reptiles and things like that, and I asked them if I could borrow their boa constrictor. And they said yes. So they brought the boa constrictor down to the weight room. And they handed it to me outside, and we set it up so that Lewis was being interviewed with a news camera for a feature that was happening anyway. So we timed it so that he would be interviewed. Lewis was at the far end of the weight room. His back was to the length of the weight room where the door was on the other end, and the camera was standing with its back to the wall, pointing out at Lewis, out towards the length of the weight room. And in I came on the far end with this boa constrictor, and the other offensive lineman too. And we tried not to crack up laughing as we walked up towards Lewis, and I put the head of the boa constrictor right next to his ear, kind of over his shoulder. And then I tapped him on the shoulder, and the camera's rolling on Lewis. And he looked over his shoulder and saw the boa constrictor and turned back and looked at the camera. And I thought, well, it doesn't affect him at all. It was just a delayed reaction, because a few seconds later, Lewis went into the panic of his life. He turned around and sprinted out of the weight room, and I think he set a new land speed record. I don't know how far he ran. He might have ran all the way to Payson or something. It was just incredible, and it was fun because we knew that Lewis wasn't going to get mad at us. Lewis was going to be in on the joke. It's okay, and it turned out that way. I don't know how long it took him to cool down to where that would be okay, but that was, in a weird way, kind of a team-building moment for the offensive line, because we loved Lewis, and we were having fun with Lewis, and Lewis was okay with being the object of the joke that time, because we all were the object of the joke at different times.
Look at the time Bosco has to throw here. Unbelievable. Now he moves up a little bit, gets a better view of things.
Entering the 1984 season, we knew we could be good. Matter of fact, we knew we were good. At least I did. I looked around and I saw these guys and I thought, what, this team has the potential to be the best team I've ever been a part of here. In the 4 years that I played on the varsity there, that were broken up by a two-year mission in between, we lost three games in those 4 years, including that one in 1983. Losing a game was a shock, because that's what we did, was win. We got to 1984, and I'm looking around at this team, and I'm thinking, this team is as good as any that I've been associated with here, as long as Robbie does his part. But of course, Robbie would do his part, because Robbie is a BYU quarterback. And you look at BYU quarterbacks, you've got Gary Shiede, Gifford Nielsen, Mark Wilson, Jim McMahon, Steve Young. Of course, Robbie's going to be great, right? Going into the season, I thought it could be a special year, but I never thought about national championship before the Pitt game, because the Pitt game seemed to be an insurmountable obstacle to think that, oh yeah, we'll just go in and win that. We knew we were good. We knew we had a chance to win it. We believed we could win it. But it wasn't the kind of thing where we were so arrogant that we thought, oh yeah, we'll just saunter on into top five team in their place and we'll just spank them. We can just count on that. They had players on that team that were candidates for the Outland Trophy and for all the big trophies, and guys that went on to be fantastic NFL players. And that was a great football team. That was an obstacle that we had to overcome before the dam broke to believe what we could actually accomplish.
Take a look at Bosco just having all kinds of time to throw.
As an offensive line, when we looked at Robbie Bosco, he wasn't just our quarterback. He was like our little brother that we needed to protect. Now, he was our leader. He was a great player. He was one of the best in the country. He was one of the top Heisman finalists that year. But we saw him, that loved one that needed to be protected from the evils of the world. And those evils were the pass rushers. We did everything we could, whether it was bite, scratch, kick, claw, it didn't matter. You know, I don't know how many sacks we gave up that year, but I don't think it was very many. And we faced some really good pass rushers, individual pass rushers that year. Against Michigan, when they cheap shotted him, when they hurt his leg in the first half, and in my opinion, it's still a cheap shot, and I'm still mad at that guy. Because Robbie had released the ball. It was gone. He was watching the ball go down the field, and that rusher kept on going and went down low and dove into Robbie's legs. I had not ever in my life contemplated committing an actual crime the way I did that moment on what I was gonna do to that guy if I got the chance in that game. And there was actually a moment where Robbie was back in the game and he was coming around the left side and I didn't have anybody to block. So I looked over there, saw him, and I started to go over towards him, and I had a clean angle on his knee. And I was gonna drive through that knee and take it with me all the way to the depths of hell. But before I made the hit, I realized that he was still in contact with the left tackle, and that would have been a penalty if I went low there. And as I'm going in to hit the guy, I thought, I can't do that because it'll be a penalty and we still got to win this game. And so I hit him high enough to where I kept him from getting to the quarterback, but I didn't draw a penalty. But I tell you what, though, it was fury in my heart in the most profoundly violent way, what I wanted to do to him because of what he did to our quarterback. That's the way we felt about Robbie. The Utah rivalry was massive because we knew how important it was to our fans, how important it was to our families, and we knew how important it was to them to beat us and to be able to brag about it. And it was like, oh, no. It was so much more personal than any other team because every team in our conference wanted to beat us and brag about it. We were everybody's Super Bowl. But for Utah, it was so personal. And the football malice, the football hatred, I want to differentiate that it's within the realm of football, was as deep as any that I've ever personally experienced or seen as a player or as a broadcaster. I mean, it was just astonishing. When you walk out there, it's not just like, we're going to beat you. It's like, we're not just going to beat you. We're going to take away from you what you want, which is the victory. And then we're going to beat you in a way that you've got no choice but to admit that we are the victors. We are superior. We didn't just win. You lost because we beat you. That's what the Utah game was about. And that was because that's what we wanted. But it's also because of we knew it was that important to everybody around us. I mean, people would be going to church on Sunday, talking about that game. People would be going to work. And Utah fans and BYU fans would be in the same workplace. And we wanted our guys to be able to have that same feeling, our fans, the people that supported us. And so that's everything.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen, the final score in today's football game, Brigham Young 24, University of Utah 14. And now across the field of play here at Rice Stadium, there is the handshaking going on. The feelings, of course, that were so intense earlier in the football game now are gone as they shake hands and say, nice going, guys.
From a football standpoint, I always hated my opponent while we were playing. I would go out pregame early. And if we were home, I'd sit in the corner of the end zone and I'd look through the corners of the stadium with the blue banners flying in the breeze and the snow-capped peaks off in the distance and just sit there and think about how beautiful this was. This is such a beautiful setting. What a great day this is for football. And then from the opposite corner, a couple of opponents would come out and start to warm up too. And I would look at them and my demeanor would change and this white hot rage would come over me. Like, how dare you come into our stadium? How dare you even be on this grass? And I knew intellectually that they had to be there. We had a football game to play. But I was enraged at them that they would dare come out of that locker room. And then that's how I played those 3 hours. Now, I knew that was a football thing. I didn't hate them actually, but Utah, I didn't just hate them. I hated everything about them. I mean, I hated that color red. I hated their pets. I hated everything about you. Just hated them. And part of the reason was that they hated us. And so, okay, game on. And here's the thing. In the 4 years that I played, the 2 years before my mission, the 2 years after my mission, I will tell you this. I've been asked what it's like to lose to your rival. And the answer is, you'll have to ask somebody else. Because my teams were 8-0 against Utah and Utah State. And you know what? It still matters. I've got tremendous respect for the Utah program. I did then, I do now. But when it's game on, it's game on. And you know, there's a saying out there in football that it just means more in some places. Utah BYU, oh boy, does that mean more. I'll tell you this about Kyle. That's one of the reasons I have so much respect for the Utah program now. Although when Utah and BYU play, that emotion is still there. When I talk about that game as an analyst on ESPN, I'm always balanced. I don't want anybody to know where I went to school when I talk about BYU and Utah. But that feeling still comes up. And when it's kickoff time, okay, all that balance goes away. In the football world, I want BYU to steamroll Utah. Outside of it, though, part of the reason I respect the Utah program so much is the way Kyle Whittingham runs that program. I mean, we were teammates at BYU. I came in as a 17-year-old, 217-pound hotshot freshman. And Kyle Whittingham introduced me to the flavor of dirt. I was a center, on the scout team, and I would go block him, and I thought, oh, well, he's just right there. I'm just going to chop him to the ground. And I'd go up and try to chop him to the ground, but before I got to him, he would throw a forearm into the back of my neck and drive me into the turf and then go make the tackle. And I would get up wondering what in the world happened, spitting grass, and go back and huddle up and do it again. And this was my first introduction to Kyle Whittingham. We finished the season 12-0, ranked number one in the nation. The national media had no idea what to think. So they descended on Provo, Utah to tell this story. Sports Illustrated shows up. They're looking for a story, and they found out that I used M&Ms the night before a game to help figure out how to make protection calls. What I would do is I would put peanut M&Ms, color-coded for position groups, on the bed, and then I'd move them into different spots. And I would imagine what protection call I would need to make based on this situation, based on what we knew they were likely to do. And then I started putting them into positions where we didn't think they would do, that we'd never seen on tape, but that they might do as an adjustment. And then what would I do as a center to make the call on that? And then when I was done, I would eat all the peanut M&Ms. And so Sports Illustrated found out about this, and they thought that was a good hook for a story. So they did a story called Beware of the Candyman. It was a 6-page story about our whole team with kind of the feature of the offensive line, but it was about all of us and kind of an explanation of how we got to where we were. And the picture at the beginning of the story were those M&Ms. That was just such a cool moment. The night before they went to press, I got a phone call at midnight from the reporter for Sports Illustrated to confirm some facts. And I'm thinking, well, this is pretty cool. I'm here in Provo at midnight, and I'm talking to the Sports Illustrated reporter in New York at 2 a.m. his time. How cool is this? I mean, this is awesome. Football is amazing. It's the best thing ever. And then at the end of the conversation, he said, by the way, how's your brother? And I said, well, I don't know. How's my brother? He said, well, you better call home. I called home. My younger brother had been playing in a high school basketball tournament. It was the first game of the tournament. He had the ball in both hands. He faked the pass over his head. The defender went for the ball, missed it, and jammed both fingers into his eyes. My brother fell to the floor. When the paramedics got there, they stopped worrying about his eyes and worried about his blood pressure because it got so low they were worried about shock. They took him to the hospital. The diagnosis was torn retinas in both eyes. The initial prognosis was that he would be legally blind. He'd be able to see light and colors and stuff like that, but he'd be legally blind for the rest of his life. So one moment I'm talking to Sports Illustrated thinking that football is the greatest thing ever. And the next moment, I'm talking to my mom about what happened to my brother, and I'm thinking, I would give this whole thing up if I could make that not happen, if it could be me instead of him, because I already had a great career. I hung up with my mom, and I jumped in the car. It was midnight, snowstorm in Utah, and I drove from Provo to Sacramento that night. I didn't tell anybody I was leaving. I just left. When I got there, there's always humor, I guess, if you want to look for it in things. My brother was told to have a bandana over his eyes so that he would not have light come into his eyes. Every morning, there was a cheerleader squad from a different school, a high school, would come over and bring him a new breakfast. Oh, here, eat my crepes. Oh, no, I made this great omelet for you. And I'm watching that thinking, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? When my brother came back from the hospital, of course, the most difficult food to eat would be peas, right? If you can't see. So what does my mom do? She puts peas on his plate and gives him a fork to eat it with. So he would be poking at the plate and then he'd pick it up and say, is there a pea on my fork? No, not yet. Try again. Okay, now you got one. She saw in the living room that there was a coffee table next to the couch. So she moved it so he wouldn't fall over it. So he walked in not being able to see because of the bandana. And he walked where he knew there wasn't supposed to be a coffee table, and he would fall over the coffee table. All kinds of crazy things happen. Mom's a wonderful mom, but, you know, in that moment, she was trying a bit too hard. A couple of days later, my brother's team was playing in the championship game of the tournament. And, of course, athletes being terrible patients, he wanted to go to be at that game. So I drove him over there. He had a bandana over his eyes. He had sunglasses over the bandana to look a little bit more cool. And so he grabbed my arm, and we walked into the gym while the teams were warming up. The cheerleaders were doing their thing. And as soon as they saw my brother, the team stopped warming up, and they cleared the court. The cheerleaders stopped. Everything went silent. And we walked over to my brother's bench, and we sat a couple of rows up above his bench. And I gave him a play-by-play of that game. And if you can imagine that moment, it was one of those moments that I would never trade for any other in my life.
Take a look at Bosco just having all kinds of time to throw.
So as we headed into the Holiday Bowl, my perspective went from football great, national championship potential, everything, to my brother. And so it was a surreal experience to practice for the Holiday Bowl and even to play the Holiday Bowl. In the moment, though, I still had a rage for those guys. But in the end, when we won the game, my thoughts went back to what was more important. And that was such a lesson about perspective, because it's so easy to get caught up in football. And in its own world, it is important. And in its own world, it is a tremendous sacrifice towards a lofty goal. But that's in its own world. And there's another world out there that's bigger, a lot bigger. And to have those two things happen at the same time were a life lesson that I've never forgotten. I think the story of BYU football in general and the 1984 season in particular was not about the championship. It was about the brotherhood. It was about how we grew. It was about the men that we became. That season was part of 1 year. Since then, it's been many, many decades. And the men that we became because of that moment together has affected our lives in such a positive way. It's affected our wives, our children, everyone around us, because we are different people than we ever would have been had we not gone through that together, had we not treated each other like we did moment by moment through the ups and downs of that season, and had we not been mentored by Lavelle Edwards and the assistant coaches that he put together. And looking back on it, that sports triumph was huge in the sports world, but I am so grateful for who we became by going through the process of achieving it.
Coming up next episode.
The rivalry, the holy war, every single year for 50 years, there's been at least one Whittingham on one side or the other. And so I'm going to tell you that we have more experience and more involvement in the rivalry than anybody that ever lived.
And this legendary speech Craig gave, he just got in the huddle. Robbie was limping. He wasn't putting weight on his ankle. And Craig was like, come on, you guys. We haven't come this far to lose. Are you kidding me? We got one more shot at this. You can do this.
Thank you for listening to Legends of 84. This podcast series was produced by Eric Michael Robertson and Scott Christofferson, with Bree Ray Alpew as associate producer. Music by Stuart Maxfield and Eric Michael Robertson. Legends of 84 is a production of BYU Radio.